Sai Ram Vivek, I am really eager to continue our conversation from where we left off this morning. If I recall, you were saying something about the different voices with which the mind and the heart speak. Can you go over that in a greater detail so that it all becomes clearer to me?
Sure, Varun. You see, when we ask ourselves a question, there are basically two voices that speak from within.
Two voices? I always thought that there was only one. How come there are two voices? And what are they saying exactly?
That is an important question. And that precisely is where the issue of identity crisis I spoke of earlier comes into the picture.
I am afraid that right now, all that you are saying sounds quite mysterious to me.
Don't worry, Varun. I shall explain it all step by step. To start with, I do hope you remember my mentioning earlier that a human being is really a mixture of three distinct entities, namely the gross body, the subtle mind, and the Atma, which I remind you is the source of everything in this universe.
Yes. Let me restate it this way. You are effectively saying that every human being is an MBA, that is, a composite of the body, the mind, and the Atma.
Hey, that's a cute way of putting it. By the way, that is how Swami himself used to describe the composition of a human being to his students.
Thanks for the compliment, Vivek. Now, would you please take the point further?
Sure. You see, Varun, the body exists in the world and is naturally highly tuned to the surroundings and what happens there. It is all a part of the evolution process, of course.
Okay, so what is wrong with that?
I'm not suggesting that anything is wrong. All I'm pointing out is that by the very nature of the evolutionary process, it is natural for the body to be focused on the world.
Okay. So what about the mind? Where is the mind's focus?
That, Varun, is the key question.
In what way?
Well, there is an aspect of our mind that is totally focused on the external world, and rightly so.
How come?
This again is the result of evolution. As you know, even lower living species have some kind of a rudimentary brain. It is the brain, with help from the various senses, of course, that keeps track of what happens around.
Okay, there is a brain-senses combination that keeps us aware of the external world. But what has that got to do with the mind?
Good question, and a key one too. I'm coming to that. Meanwhile, let us note that the combination made up of the senses and the brain serves an important purpose, namely, it aids survival.
You mean like a deer in the forest picking up warning signals that perhaps there is a tiger in the neighborhood, and using that information, it tries to quietly sneak far away from the tiger?
That's exactly right. The senses-brain combination facilitates what I might call the external awareness.
You mean being conscious of the world around us, right?
Correct. Thanks to the brain working in active conjunction with the senses, we are able to be aware or conscious of the external world.
Now you used two interesting words, awareness and consciousness. Any difference between the two?
In my view, there certainly is. I would say that being aware implies mere recognition of the existence of something in the world around us. And being conscious means understanding the implications of what exists. At least that is the way I see it.
See, you appear to be making a difference between awareness and consciousness. If true, any reason why you're doing so?
Sure, I am trying to make a difference. For instance, take the Himalayas. Even when one is miles away, one can see the ice and the snow on the mountains. A tiger prowling in the foothills can see the snow on the mountains, just as a forest ranger living in the forest there also can. To the tiger, the snow exists, but does not mean anything in particular. The forest ranger, on the other hand, knows that during summer, there is water in the stream near his lookout cabin because of melting snow. There is, in this case, a higher level of awareness that enables the ranger to connect the snow in the mountain far away with water in the stream near his house, especially in summer. He is not merely aware of the existence of snow, but is conscious of the role that the snow plays, at least to a certain extent.
That sure is an interesting point.
And an important one too, Varun.
In a vague way, I understand that. But I presume the difference is important from a spiritual point of view. Isn't that the point you're trying to make?
That is exactly correct. You see, Varun, like all beings, humans too have a brain, senses and awareness.
Except that in humans, the brain is extraordinarily developed.
Considering the utterly bizarre ways in which humans sometimes behave, you know, I wonder. But anyway, I shall not get into that right now. What I would like to state at this point of time is that in humans, consciousness about the external world is very highly developed.
I notice you are cautiously using the phrase external world, implying there is a lot more.
Indeed there is, and I'm glad you have spotted the point even before I have mentioned it. You see, Varun, our capacity of being aware and conscious is not due entirely to the combination of the senses and the brain, referred to by many scientists as the meat machine. There is a superior agency called the mind that is not made up of just atoms and molecules. It is actually a subtle entity, and it is this mind that endows human with so much capability and power.
This is getting to be interesting. As I see it, you are making a distinction between the brain and the mind, right?
That is correct.
Is there a universal acceptance of this view?
No, there is not. There is actually quite a split where opinions on this matter are concerned. And we can discuss that later, maybe. Right now, whatever I am saying is based entirely on Vedantic principles, particularly as expounded by Lord Krishna a long time ago and elaborated in great detail in recent times by our own beloved Swami.
Okay, if I am to put what I have gathered so far in simple terms, they are the following. 1. The mind is something much superior to and beyond the brain. 2. The mind is unique to humans. 3. The mind is subtle and not a meat machine, as some scientists would have us believe. Finally, the 4th point, mind is extremely powerful.
You have beautifully summarized all that I wanted to say, Varun, and very crisply too. But there is one more thing I should add.
Which is?
The mind helps us to ask deep questions and look beyond the external world.
That I am not able to understand. Although something in me tells me that you are making an important point.
Yeah, that is a most encouraging comment, Varun. And now, before we proceed further, let us remind ourselves once more of the crucial fact that every single human being is really a composite of 3 distinct entities.
You mean the gross body, the subtle mind and the causal atma, right?
Yes, of course. And I'm glad you recall them correctly, especially at this juncture. You see, Varun, our personality, our emotions, our character, the way we react to people and events, all these are critically dependent on how this mix is.
I do not quite follow what you're trying to say.
Okay, let me put it this way. Consider a person who is not educated and besides being illiterate, is crude, uncouth, a prey to all vices, gets angry in a flash, who is rather selfish and greedy, you know, becomes jealous very easily, is prone to violence and so on. You would agree that there are people like that in this world today, isn't it?
Oh, sure. In plenty too. Some of them even supposedly educated.
Okay, we agree there. Let us now go to the underlying question. Why are these people like that? I mean, what makes them behave the way they do?
That is a complicated question. I mean, a person who has lived almost all alone deep in the forest, a kind of a tribal, would behave like you said when he comes into contact with you and me. Perhaps he would feel insecure in the company of people of a very different mold, and that insecurity would make him behave worse than he really is.
I must compliment you, Varun, for giving a thoughtful and objective reply. Indeed, there is much truth in what you say, and your remarks help me in crisply discussing the factors that shape our personality and how they manage to do it.
Yeah, that is something I'm very keen to know about.
Well, here it is. Varun, there is no doubt it all started with the Atma. not merely our own particular lives, but indeed the whole creation. As Krishna emphatically declares in the Gita, everything in the universe has come from Him. That is to say, He is the primordial seed from which everything has sprung.
So when you say there is Atma within us, it is a reference to the divine genes with us?
Oh, Varun, that's a cute phrase you have used. In a manner of speaking, each of us has really three genes that shape us, each in their own particular way.
Three genes?
Biologically speaking, there is only one type, the one that leads to our physical body, determining in the process the color of our skin, our eyes, our hair and so on. But then, as you yourself just now pointed out, we also have the divine genes.
The divine gene stuff was something I just made up.
Maybe, but the fact of the matter is that this divine gene, as you call it, is indeed a component of our personality. Thus, while our body can be traced back to the biological gene, our atmic nature can be traced to the divine gene as you have so beautifully described it.
Vivek, earlier you said that we are made up of the body, the mind and the atma. We have assigned a gene to two of the three entities. What about the third entity?
You mean the mind?
Yeah, that's right. Can one associate any kind of gene with the mind?
Indeed, we can.
Any name for the gene that might be associated with the mind?
Sure. It is called the vasanas.
I see. Can you say something more? I mean, if the bio genes came from the parents and ancestors, while the divine gene came from God Himself, where did these vasanas come from?
Very good question, Varun.
And the answer is?
It comes from us. We alone are responsible for the vasanas.
Come on, Vivek. You must be joking, right? I have never heard of any such thing before.
Sure, you would not have read it in any modern science book, but it is all there in Vedanta. And Krishna explains in detail how the vasanas play a critical role in shaping our personality.
All this is so new to me that you had better explain it slowly and in such a manner that spiritually ignorant techie like me can understand.
No problem. You see, Varun, when modern scientists consider evolution, they focus on only two aspects of it. On the one hand, there are the astronomers, the astrophysicists, the elementary particle physicists, and of course the cosmologists, for whom evolution means the full story of the creation and the development of the physical universe from the Big Bang right up to what the universe is today.
And I suppose these folks are interested only in inert matter.
That is exactly right. They would talk about everything from how the baby universe was when it was just 10 to the power minus 35 seconds old, all the way to birth and death of stars, formation of planets, quasars, supernova explosions, dark matter, dark energy, you name it. But it is always about inert matter.
When you say inert matter, you of course mean matter that has no life in it.
Correct. But we know that the story of the universe cannot be told entirely in terms of evolution of inert matter alone. There is life, at least here on Earth, and we have to explain that too.
But I believe many biologists have grappled with that problem.
Indeed, and it all goes back in a sense to Charles Darwin, who was the one who first speculated seriously how living species evolved.
And if I understand correctly, since then there have been many lines of attack on this question of the origin and the evolution of living species.
You're right, yes. There are some who spend all their time figuring out how it was that life first appeared on our Earth roughly 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. I believe our Earth itself came into existence when a new solar system with our Sun as the parent star came into existence about 5 billion years ago.
And just to put it all in perspective, the age of the universe is?
The best estimate obtained recently from some beautiful and accurate satellite experiments is that our universe is about 13.8 billion years old, give or take a few hundred million years.
So, if I get you correctly, there has been much discussion among scientists on two strands of evolution. The evolution of inert matter all the way from the Big Bang, and the evolution of life, at least here on Earth, all the way from the appearance of the first living molecule about 3.5 billion or so years ago.
Right. This is a nice summary, Varun, of what we have been discussing thus far.
Okay, but Where does the mind fit into all this?
Ah, that is the question we are coming to. And it is quite a fascinating story. You may say that this story adds a third strand to the history of evolution.
So the evolution story has really three strands and not just two? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And this third strand is connected with the all-important issue of consciousness.
And scientists do not talk about this third strand?
Not at the professional level. However, there are, at the private level, many eminent scientists who are breaking out to express views that are very different from the orthodox clan, if I might say so.
Wow, sounds absolutely fascinating.
Indeed it is, Varun. But if you have seen your watch, you would realize that we must postpone that discussion to another session.
Oh God, why is it that we must always take a break when things get real interesting?
That, my friend, is how the media converts a simple story into a serial. Anyway, seriously speaking, that part of our discussion would require a lot more time. And so, maybe it is wise for us to take up that in a new session.
Which means we break for now and resume as usual during our night walk. Is that it?
Right. Okay then. Come on, let's go.